Okay, so we are starting the second part of our interview, and in the first part we talked about the field of piano pedagogy and how it evolved, and then also we talked about the piano method that Dr. Kohler co-authored, the Celebrate Piano Method. So for this part, we're going to talk about piano lessons and some pedagogical questions. So let's start with, I would like to dig your brain a little bit.
Okay.
On what pedagogical issues you think are present in specific composers. So let's start with Bach.
Okay, and these are very general principles because every piece and every composer presents all sorts of major issues. But I'm going to give you some general principles that I think are key to each composer. So Bach, obviously one of the hardest things is the contrapuntal movement of his, where each hand oftentimes has a line or the major theme, and it moves to the other line. So certainly right, correct balances, hearing the right line at the right time as it moves from right hand to left hand is very important in playing contrapuntal music. So problem one, balance, voicing. In Bach, usually having worked for 37 years with students of all ages, whether they're college performance majors or young students first learning Anna Magdalena Bach, the issue is oftentimes articulation and how we choose to articulate legato and staccato. So making those choices, because of course in original Bach music it's not edited in. Of course you can find editions of Bach that have made suggestions, but knowing certain principles that guide us in each period of music is very important. I find that some of my most advanced students oftentimes can't decide what they think needs to be brought out or what is the theme or the idea. And so finding the phrase, because oftentimes I find the weakest point in more advanced performances of Bach is the fact that we breeze right through cadential points. So finding starting and stopping points in Bach is hard. Ornamentation. Now I've already given you four different problems. Certainly learning trills and mordants and turns and all of the various ornaments that we find in Bach is a challenge for the youngest to the most advanced pianist.
Now, I remember one of our classes, in one of our pedagogy classes, what we did with Bach pieces was you had us go through it and say, okay, where does this phrase end? And I just remember that class, we had so many different answers of where this phrase ends. And it's like nobody knew exactly what tells us where the phrase ends. And I remember that in that lecture you also mentioned that one of the biggest problems is that, you know, students just kind of play through the whole thing. You know, there's no, because like you said, it's not marked in the music where the phrases end. So I thought that was a very interesting lecture, and I learned a lot from that. You also mentioned balance. That's a really hard thing to teach piano students. I'm having some trouble with that right now with some students. How do you get a student to balance well?
Well, first of all, it's understanding and recognizing that the two hands do not play at the same volume all the time. There is an oral component to that, so being able to hear the difference. But there's also a tactical difference in the hands. So one of the first things that we probably did in pedagogy was that I oftentimes will take a student's arm and play on the back and say which hand is using more power.
Okay.
And you would say right now, right or left?
Right.
Uh-huh. Okay. And now?
Left.
And so, and then sometimes I'll work with students with the two hands and say, pull with greater strength here, and now pull with greater strength in your left hand.
Okay.
And so that they start feeling that their use of power in the two hands is different.
Okay. Okay.
And but of course they have to recognize it orally when they start playing. All of the things that we tried to do in Celebrate Piano, technically, one should do. So if you have a student who's working on a Hannon exercise,
uh-huh.
obviously you need to apply that idea to the Hannon exercise.
Okay.
Have them play the right hand loud, left hand soft. Play the left hand loud, right hand soft. Change the articulation, left hand legato, right hand staccato. Mm-hmm. All the things that you would confront in Bach, you should be able to play in your Hannon exercise or the simplest of exercises that your students might be playing. You do the same thing with your scales.
Okay.
And I think I saw that you posted something about that.
Scales? I did.
Yeah, that's exactly the correct way to go.
Okay, would you say scales, you know, would be a good place to begin practicing balance as opposed to having a piece and be like, okay, at this point, you got to make the accompaniment softer and a minute louder and then try and teach balance there. Would it be better to start with the scale and be like, okay, play one hand loud, one hand soft?
Yes, because then you aren't having to concern yourself with the notes,
okay,
the rhythms,
yeah,
leaps or other technical issues that might be there. So in the very early stages of a piano method, mm-hmm. if a student is playing a simple five-finger exercise, of course they should start learning that they can play one hand loud, one hand soft. So it should start at the very early stages.
Okay.
That kind of awareness.
Yeah. Okay. So Bach repertoire, you talk about all the difficulties in it. In your teaching, how would you sequence Bach music? Like, what would you start to introduce children to Bach? You know, what's the progression you would say introduce the pieces in?
Just an individual piece? What do I do first in the piece? Or do you mean what
series
the literature?
Pieces. Yeah, literature.
Well, of course, when it starts with the Anna Magdalena Bach book first.
Okay.
And then generally you would move into the W.F. Bach book, which includes the little preludes and fugues, or some people will call them the short preludes and fugues. That we tend to move into those, and a lot of our collections of repertoire that you see published will progress that way, starting with the little minuets mm-hmm. and musettes of Bach, and then progressing to the little prelude in C major or any of the ones that we would have in the W.F. Bach book.
Mm-hmm.
Traditionally, then, you could go into some of the easier movements of a French suite, for instance.
Okay.
But a lot of teachers, after the little preludes and fugues, will move into the two-part inventions. So then two-part inventions, three-part inventions can get pretty tricky. And so sometimes I will go from two-part inventions to the French suites or suite movements and then to the symphonias or three-part inventions. And then moving on to the more difficult suites or the preludes and fugues.
Okay, cool. So that's for me to know. I would like to know that.
Okay. I would have thought we talked about it. Okay.
We did, but you know, I didn't write it down. So.
Okay, no problem.
Okay, so on to the next big B in music, Beethoven. What would you say about Beethoven?
Beethoven can be very tricky with rhythm.
Okay.
And certainly, not that Bach isn't, but I think of certainly a lot of rhythmic issues. A lot of his faster first movements of even sonatinas
mm-hmm.
require a lot of scale type passages. So being very secure with very strong fingers playing those 16th note passages is very important. Another, again, back to the balance issue, because of course in Beethoven we tend to see a melody in one hand with an accompaniment in the other, oftentimes the right hand having the melody, but it can change. A lot of students have trouble with Alberti bass, being able to keep it moving, and legato,
mm-hmm.
Another issue. Certainly, articulation. In the classical period, looking at a lot of both Mozart and Beethoven tended to use small little two-note slurs,
mm-hmm.
A lot of staccato in combination. One of the things that I think teachers have a little more trouble with is then taking those small units and making a longer phrase with it so that the entire phrase is shaped.
Mm-hmm.
And so those would be some of the things that I would think about in Beethoven. We can also use touches of pedal, the damper pedal. So it's learning how and where to best use pedal in Beethoven, because we certainly can be starting to use the damper pedal more
mm-hmm.
in the classical period.
Okay. This kind of goes back to Bach, actually. What is your view on pedaling in Bach?
Usually I teach it without. Trying to get the legato and the articulation, the legato sound with the fingers as opposed to the pedal. Again, there are certain passages, I've got preludes and fugues going through my head, where to execute certain choral type cadential patterns that I will use pedal at a cadential mm-hmm. pattern. But rarely will I use it on 16th note passages or on ornaments in Bach. It's generally reserved for places where you might need the pedal to help you execute a more difficult legato. But for the most part, it's my golden rule to start without pedal in Bach.
Okay.
Yeah, I know that we had the controversy, well, it was written for harpsichord,
yeah.
which of course does not have a damper pedal, and so to get the right kind of sound, one wouldn't use the pedal, but there is certainly a whole school of people that say, well, now that we're playing them on the modern instrument,
yeah.
shouldn't we take the advantage of the entire instrument? So you certainly can use it tastefully. It should not be obvious to the listener that they're hearing pedal in Bach.
Yeah, so you're now at the school of that. Bach, no pedal.
No, I'm not of that school. I will, but I use it judiciously.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay. Back to Beethoven. You mentioned Alberti bass as in Beethoven. And personally, you know, I don't remember ever struggling learning Alberti bass personally, but it wasn't until I was teaching class piano at San Diego State, you know, teaching the college music majors, that I realized how difficult it is to do Alberti bass. Like, you know, a lot of students just had so much trouble coordinating the two hands,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I tell them, you know, really slowly, just think one note at a time, and it's just impossible. And how do you go about teaching Alberti bass?
In class piano, it's quite different because, of course, for music majors, you're moving very quickly, which
mm-hmm.
goes back to our initial discussion about the repetition and the amount of opportunity that a student has. Four semesters of class piano, it's pretty hard to develop for a non-pianist, the types of coordination that an Alberti bass requires.
That's true. Yeah.
The beauty is that with younger students, of course, they're going to have numerous pieces that are going to use Alberti bass. They have more opportunity, and hopefully if their materials are sequenced well
mm-hmm.
and their technical development is sequenced well, they should have less problem because they've learned the hand coordination or the
yeah.
hand-eye coordination that's required for that kind of skill. We have to move them so much faster in class
yeah.
piano that it's really very hard. But it shows that, it once again, it's just not a mind thing, that there is a certain amount of repetition that has to happen in certain patterns. With Alberti bass, certainly having the student, first of all, block the harmony so they see what the notes are that are being used,
mm-hmm.
and oftentimes having them practice that left hand in rhythms,
okay.
Ways.
Expand on practicing the left hand in rhythm. What do you mean by that?
Well, besides just blocking at first, which is one rhythm, doing dotted eighths and sixteenths,
okay.
or doing since oftentimes an Alberti bass might either be in 4/8 notes or 4/16 notes, doing one long note and then three shorter or quicker notes, and then going from doing a 5-note pattern where you would do, let's in the key of F major, F, C, A, C, and then back to the F of the next group. So having the student practice in different kinds of pattern. But of course, it's also keeping the hand and the tension on the hand light enough that oftentimes what happens is students start pressing and bearing down on their hand, so it locks the hand and the wrist, and so it's keeping the wrist flexible and the bridge up, all the things to keep the Alberti bass easier to play.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, now let's go to Chopin. Because lots of students I know, or lots of parents actually, have heard Chopin music and they love it. And, you know, one of the first things is like, when is my kid going to start playing Chopin? And, you know, it's like, well. So what are some hard issues for Chopin music?
With all of the romantics, I would say the first thing is because it has a beautiful melody. It's first of all, finding the shape of that wonderful melody. Oftentimes, Chopin does write in a dynamic shape on a phrase, but like all the other composers, his music often goes into a longer phrase that isn't marked by a long phrase mark. And so it's finding that phrase, finding the peak of the phrase, then finding where you release some of the energy on the phrase so that it has a beautiful dynamic shape. Second, of course, coming into the romantics is the use of rubato.
Yeah.
And so it's finding places where the student can have give and take in the line as well. All the different ways that we can approach rubato. And being another issue with the romantics, but Chopin in as well. Of course, we don't have younger pieces. Certainly we have some mazurkas and preludes, the waltzes that are the easier types of Chopin pieces, but oftentimes a teacher is going to be working with the easier Schumann pieces before we ever approach Chopin. But, of course, the pedal, the damper pedal, becomes a more prominent element in the Romantic period. And so developing pedal technique. And so I find that already with my middle school students who might be playing Chopin, learning that there's more than one depth on the pedal, that it's not all the way down and all the way off. So timing, so it's a whole other technical issue that has to be an expressive issue that has to be addressed when teaching Chopin and the Romantics.
Okay. In terms of pedaling, for a kid to first start learning pedaling, how do you break down the syncopated pedaling and teach it step by step? How do you teach a kid how to pedal correctly, pretty much?
Well, and most of it, here's again why one would hope that a teacher would continue to use a method longer, because every one of our modern methods does include pedal practice and pedal exercises that really provide a variety of ways that a student should initially look at the pedal. Most of the methods start with what's called direct or straight pedal, which is down with the note and then held for a long period of time and then released, so that they're looking at that marking. But you asked particularly about syncopated pedal. Oftentimes with syncopated pedal, you see that the key elements or the key ways of teaching that is either playing a scale or even a five-finger pattern with one finger, where the student plays, if we're playing a C major scale, C and the pedal goes down. Then you move your 2 to D, play the D, and you lift the pedal and it goes down right after. So it's doing, because obviously you can hear very clearly if you play a scale with one finger, that if you've let go of the pedal at the wrong time, it's going to create a break in the sound. Okay. Another thing that a lot of the methods would use in teaching it is to go up diatonic triads, where you do a C major, again in the key of C major, D minor, E minor, going up the white key triads, and again using a syncopated, where the next chord is played, and as you play the chord, the pedal is released and then goes down right after it. Sometimes I will also do it with counting, where we release on one and go down on and. So it becomes a very rhythmic activity.
Yeah.
But, you know, if a chord is held for three beats, in other words, that you would play the chord, the pedal goes down on and, two, and, three, and, up, and it goes down on the and.
Okay. It's a very good information. I've never heard of all these different ways to so you can pay the pedal. I just gotta do this, you know, like I have to do it really slowly, and this is where you take. Okay, all right, I'll keep all these. I'll take notes when I watch this again.
It's creating, you know, and as you develop as a teacher, you find different activities and exercises that you can develop that instead of just watch me or do this. Going back again to the whole idea of why pedagogy and pedagogy degrees is there's so much to know.
Yeah.
One has to constantly, it's just not do this, but finding ways that help the student to practice better, which is so important. And so the different activities you can create to help your student to time things or rhythmically prepare things, very important.
Because, I mean, you know, when I teach pedaling, you know, while I'm doing it, I'm always thinking there has to be a better way to do this, you know. I'm thinking, okay, I got to break it down into steps, you know, make it simple, what's the next thing? But, you know, I always go away from it feeling like there has to be a better way to do it. And I think one of the biggest things I learned from the pedagogy program is, one of the biggest things is just evaluating my own teaching.
Great. You
know, just realizing when something doesn't feel right and going back. You know, being able to go back home and be like, okay, how could I have made that better? And knowing how to think about different problems. And I think that's really just the biggest thing. It's just getting in the habit of evaluating my own teaching.
That's wonderful. You're never too old to find a new way to do things. Every time I look at a student and do a lesson, I am constantly asking myself now, because every student is different and practices differently, comes back in different stages of preparation, and a teacher is a good improviser. In other words, you have to have a whole group of activities and be constantly thinking of new ones, because you will see throughout your teaching career that as you try to communicate something to one student that maybe worked with a different student, that somehow that didn't quite make it with the new student. And so you have to, it's great that you're going home and thinking back through your teaching and saying, okay, how could have I addressed that better? What kind of activities could I design that would help the student to see it?
Yeah, and I think it really is a different kind of thinking. Like, when a lesson doesn't go well, instead of being like, oh, the student should practice more, or, you know, they just weren't having a good day, they're not paying attention, you know, instead it's a change of thinking in that, okay, I must have not done something right. You know, how could I make it better? It's, you know, it's like placing the blame on myself and being like, okay, how could I have been better next time?
It's both. Don't take all the blame on yourself. Because needless to say, students come in not prepared all the time. And so, you know, there are times that, and certainly you're going to find over your teaching career that you are sometimes having to repeat your strategies. I'm constantly trying to figure ways that I can make sure that the student understands what it is, whether it's that dad brings a video cam and we set it up and they can review the lesson to see what it is. But certainly one of the things that I try to be two ways that I try to be very specific about with my students how to practice, because they can forget. Is, you know, on my assignment sheets, as you know, I prepare a computer-generated assignment for each individual student. And then what I list on the sheet are the steps that I want them to take with each piece. Mm-hmm. And so my time is quickly listing out those steps rather than worrying about writing the name of the piece and the various ways they practice it that way. So certainly finding ways you can communicate better with your students is important, but I think it's very healthy to after every lesson, to take some time and reflect on, well, did that go the way I wanted it to go? How can I make it better? If a student isn't practicing, are there things I need to suggest to the parents to improve that practice? Do we need to video some of the lessons? Do I need to get a practice assistant for that student?